Okay, this is part one of civil service interview with Howard Titherly, IT consultant for the Civil Service Verification Project, the Public Service Reform Unit in Sierra Leone. Interviewer is Summer Lopez. And thank you for talking with us. I'd like to begin the conversation just by talking about the role you have played in public sector reform here, as well as elsewhere if you've done similar work in other places. So if you could start out by briefly describing your current position and responsibilities and any related posts you've held over the past several years.
Okay. My current position is the IT consultant with the Records Management Improvement Team, who are doing the payroll verification for the government of Sierra Leone. We are interviewing every single civil servant on the payroll in Sierra Leone, which is about 14,000 people. My background before this was I was a VSO volunteer, came out here to do a different project which then stalled, and I got adopted by this project. So I worked on this project for 9 months, and the pilot scheme, there was a pilot done of 2,000 civil servants who we interviewed and published the results, and now the government wants to go ahead with the main project. So I was a volunteer on the pilot, and now I'm a paid consultant on the main project.
Great. And can you just describe the project a little bit for us?
Okay. It's evolved from records management, which is an unusual sort of place to start, but a great place to start for payroll verification. So the civil service records were in a very poor state. They burnt down the records office a couple of times in deliberate attempts to destroy the records. People weren't keeping records as a sort of a culture, and so there was a program set up to try to just get the basic information about every single civil servant on the payroll. So we're just talking name, date of birth, date of first appointment, and a few sort of key details like maybe the names of the letter of first appointment, some key technical documentation. Not talking to the Western standards, just enough to prove they exist. So started off doing this exhaustive search from room to room, trying to rebuild the records, and the team did exceptionally well at actually getting some records on almost everyone on the payroll. So that worked quite well, and we got that. That's about where I joined the project, and they were trying to measure sort of how well they were doing, and they wanted a database of the number of anomalies they had found. An anomaly could be where the file data differs from the payroll data, or it could have an internal inconsistency. So I set up a simple database to record all of the anomalies we discovered. That project went very well, finished about Christmas last year, and we worked out actually the only other source of information for a lot of these discrepancies and omissions in the data was an interview. And interviewing people when you already have the best possible record you can get is a lot more powerful than just doing headcount. So we designed a pilot scheme with DFID's assistance. Well, not assistance, they paid. Then enthusiastic support. And we then put 2,000 people sort of drawn at random from the Ministry of Health through an interview where we actually present them with the information we have on file, ask them to provide any omissions and to verify any data that we do have. And so the end result of which is that the data you have has been verified. An awful lot of material came in. The pilot interview brought in thousands of extra pieces of information. That interview we photocopy everything. So if someone comes along and they've got a copy of a particular form, their letter of appointment or something, we record the details and we photocopy it. and we then file it. So the filing system sort of suddenly took a massive hit, and it took us weeks to file it after the end of the program. So we've suddenly got all the filing system up to date. We've got a good computerized record because we build that as we go through. And better still, if you didn't show up for interview, we removed you. And so non-attendance at the interview was mandated by the establishment secretary as being basically, if you don't exist, we're going to remove you. So we'll probably come back to that in a bit more detail later. But the pilot was outrageously successful. Interviewed 2,000 people. Well, invited 2,000 people for interview. 234 did not attend. And despite massive attempts, so we had an executive order from the cabinet, and we removed 234 names from the payroll. But far, far better than that was that we, with the data, the improved data that we now hold on the people, 100 people were due for retirement. So they were properly pensioned off, received their due, so pensions and everything. So that's 334 people gone. And the biggest one for me, the biggest sort of win for us at the pilot, was that we then knew who was supposed to be working in each location. So we literally stuck it to the wall. We go around to the hospitals and we pin a list of all the nurses who are supposed to be working there. And believe me, matron loved that. So a couple of weeks later we went back. In fact, I learned about this from talking to a guy in a bar, as you do. And we went back and asked the matron how she was getting on, and she loved it. Because she had a list of who was supposed to be working there, and all the people who said, "Oh, I'm off on a long-term training, I've been transferred," who hadn't, suddenly were back under matron's thumb, and they reopened two new wards in Connaught Hospital because of the increased attendance of nurses. You don't get much better than that. So we saved not 234 ghosts off the payroll. 100 people were retired, and of the ones who returned, who stayed, and who were valid, more showed up for work. So you can see that people were quite chuffed, quite pleased with how the pilot went. So the government of Sierra Leone, everyone from President down really has just said, "You're doing it again." It was almost a race of could the government pay before DFID? And DFID was saying, no, we like it. You save your money for something else. So it was very good. We've set the bar quite high for ourselves. And literally yesterday, we started interviewing every single person. So we've done a good pilot, and now we're going to do everybody else.
And how do you get people to come to the interviews? You said there was a massive effort to make sure people attend.
Communication, communication, communication. You just... we go on the radio. We put posters on everywhere. And all of the posters are, if you know a colleague who hasn't seen this, tell them. Because there's colleagues out in the wilds. We advertise on the on the TV and on the radio and newspapers. I think I've repeated radio a couple of times there. It's quite important in the rural regions. It's about the only quick communications mechanism. So, the second advantage of good communication is everybody knows you're coming and why. And so if anyone starts kind of pushing back, their motives are instantly suspect. So the more public, the more solemn dance you make about it, the harder you are to thwart. So when we arrive and a Paramount Chief sees us, we're welcomed. Without casting any assertions, the people who are in power are the ones who have the most to lose from us sort of taking out ghost workers. So sort of, they're the ones who will be least pleased to see us, but similarly, you know, with the right amount of publicity, they're the ones who also have to help. So it's a quite an important part of that, if you don't mind me rambling on. Where do I start? I slightly lost my thread there, so I'll come back to that if you answer the next question.
I did have a next question. Yes. So what happens to people who did not show up for their interviews but had a valid reason or would like to redress being removed from the payroll after the fact?
There is an appeals process. Essentially, you have to get your manager to write to the establishment secretary, head of civil service there, to explain why you were unable to attend interview at your place of work for 3 months, and why your ministry was similarly unable to say why you weren't able to attend. So of 234 people, I think around about 30 have appealed so far, and so far the minister has allowed one back on. No one has been able to say that they've been away for 3 months. Sorry, there's a printer going off behind you.
Okay, this is part two of the interview with Howard Tetherly. Sorry, go ahead.
So, I think I've just about finished what I was saying. I have remembered what I was going to say. Let's carry on through the interview. I'll fill in at the end of that. Unless it's a case of what are we trying to do here? I mean, we are not trying to catch the ghosts. Our goal is to get a payroll that is clean, where every single person who's being paid exists and has good records. So the communications help drive them away. If they know you're coming, they know the questions you're going to ask, they know they're going to be asked. Publishing the list of who we were going to interview, rather than everyone, you'd have thought it was the black spot of death. You know, so the number of people who suddenly moved away died. The payroll does a lot of cleaning of itself if you let it. If you make a song and dance and give notice, and if you say what we're going to take your photograph, we're going to do the biometrics, almost as a threat. So get out while you still can. Find another way of ripping the government off, because this door is closing. So you communicate that beforehand, because if you corner someone, if you sort of surround the building and come in and say, we're checking your records and doing a headcount, then you're going to get a lot of pushback. If you let them go, you end up with a clean payroll, and the ones who are, quite frankly, dumb enough to get caught, you refer to the Anti-Corruption Commission. All our results go to the ACC and are public. So anyone, if they want to start investigating, they're more than welcome, but quite frankly, our attitude is that the ghosts stop here. We're not a police force. We're not trying to catch them, we're trying to drive them away. And that's took us a little while to work out of, what do we do if we find evidence of corruption? We just record it and report it. And we don't try and say, oi. That improves the safety of our interviewers as well, and it gives yet fewer reasons why we get pushback. So far, everyone has welcomed us.
That was going to be my other question, was if there was much pushback to the trial.
No one has pushed back at all. Now, some people have said, could you do the... we've had some doctors who've been upset when the interview took 15 minutes when they got people bleeding on the floor, which is understandable, but there's been no pushback other than the sheer practical, could you do it in this room, you're causing a bit of disruption here, there. Just the practicalities of getting every member of staff through a 15-minute interview. Technically 14 minutes, 37 seconds was our average. I do the stats.
And is there any preparation in place for if there is stronger pushback while you're out and doing this more in the field?
Yes. When we're in the field, and literally, remember they started yesterday, the first thing they do, visit Paramount Chief, Chief of Police, and the regional, also the most senior civil servant in that region or department or city, and introduce themselves to get the support. If they, you know, they we've never needed it so far, touch wood, but you know, we will call in the police for security. We do have a small budget to have security if we need it. So far, everyone has been absolutely fine. The worst we've had is someone storm out because he refused to be interviewed by a girl. And as it turned out, he was actually not a valid worker. So he didn't appeal when we knocked him off the payroll. So when we invited him for to be interviewed by the establishment secretary and to appeal, he didn't. So that was just bluff and bravado. So far, no security issues on a personal level. Obviously, we have to lock our kit up and back it up in 5-6 different ways because the laptops will go missing at regular intervals.
And so if you're doing this on laptops now, is it all going to be digital records at this point?
It's digital records of the interview. And so we maintain a mixed mode. We have the digital record tells us what we have on file. So it will have, effectively, just a yes, we have the original called PSC, Public Service Commission 8 form. So your original appointment letter. Yes, we have an original medical form. Yes, we have the et cetera, et cetera. So yes, we have the key documents, tick, cross. So when someone arrives with a form we don't have, we photocopy it, so we have the hard copy, and we sort of tick the box. So we keep a digital record of what we have, and but the hard copy is still the master. So we've actually proposed an improved version where we're actually going to now, once we've got all of this data, start a document management system. So we can actually recall it slightly quicker and improve security, because files go missing at an alarming rate, even from a locked filing room. But that's part two of our program. Three, technically.
And as far as the trial, have you seen a change in the way that the payroll actually worked? Does it increase reliability of pay for people? Have there been any pay increases?
They had it fairly well sorted. There's been a lot of automation of the civil service payroll beforehand, so a system called IFMIS, the Integrated Financial Management Information System, and an awful lot of people were paid by bank, directly by bank transfer. And so I wouldn't say we've made it any more efficient, we've just stopped paying quite so many people into spurious bank accounts. So I don't think we've changed how it's paid. That's sort of the AG's job. We've just changed the quality of records about who's being paid. Interesting one on the payment into bank accounts. The managers of various hospitals we were talking to hated it because they no longer had the list of pay slips. So they no longer had to make someone show up and hand over the pay slip. So they felt disenfranchised by staff being paid directly into a bank account because they didn't know who was supposed to work there or whatever. And the communication of the payroll, had failed. No one liked saying it, but it wasn't getting down to the actual managers at the sites. So they didn't know, they didn't have an up-to-date staff list. So that's why they loved it when we came along with one. So they hated it, but also it meant that the money went straight to the person without being interfered with on the way. So I would never advocate changing it. If you can pay direct transfer, do it. But you've got to have the piece of procedure well established that gets the information down to the right level of management, and that's very low. You know, so that people, they know who's still working there, and the old pay slips they understood and they could manage, but it meant that a nurse could nip off and work for an NGO up country, and still claim money here, and she just had to say, "Oh, I've been transferred." No one had any way of checking. And if you wrote to the ministry would take 6 weeks to reply, and it would all be forgotten about. So the nurse just swanned off, did whatever they liked, carried on paying, receiving their pay. And a nurse who'd been taking her pay for 3 years and hadn't shown up. Everyone thought she'd gone to the UK.
So what are some of the lessons that you have learned from this so far that you think could possibly be transferred to other places?
Good question. I'm trying to remember the lessons we took out of the final report, but get the record straight first. Doing a headcount gives you a headcount, but if you get your, the team will wear face masks and gloves and going through old records, finding every piece of information they possibly could about every single person. And then take it out and use that as the basis of your payroll verification. And there's really only two questions you're asking. If you've got the piece of information, is this right? If you haven't got it, can you give it to us? So, and you agree what information you want to get out of out with your stakeholders, but pretty much there's a few which everyone's going to want, which is going to be sort of a consistent mapping of whatever digit or ID to a consistent name, to a consistent date of birth and first appointment, because that's the one. Those are the two that have the big fiscal hit. And then name, grades, designations, place of work. A few of those, get them sorted, and get as much data as possible first, then computerize, then verify. And in the verification exercise, we were swamped by the amount of paper. People love keeping their own records. They're better at it than most ministries. So people would come in with sort of folders full of almost every communication they've ever received. So you can rebuild the file by taking a photocopier in the back of a car. Photocopiers use a huge amount of power, so take a bigger generator than they say you need. And on the technical side of things, sort of the biometrics work, but they work more effectively almost as a threat to remove the ghosts than the actual need to take photos and thumbprints. Photos are superb because they allow you to review the data with non-technical staff and data much more easily. So once you've got your list of people who showed up at the interview, you can sit down with Matron and say, okay, these are the people who say they work for you. And, I haven't seen her for months. She hasn't shown. She's supposed to be here. Yep. So that pictures, a picture does speak 1,000 words. So I do, but a simple webcam will do. Just I think there's all sorts of technical side of things, but travel light. We've just seen one of the other organisations who are trying to do some payroll verification, and the amount of gear they want to install in a play in. It's you can't travel with that. You can't run it out of the back of a car with a small generator. And you won't get power, you won't get, so we're doing it in the wet season. If you can't carry it and run, it'll be soaked. So, travel light.
So what equipment are you using?
Okay, every single interviewer has a laptop running Microsoft Access, which has a database containing the entire civil service records, which is encrypted. Probably not to UK government standards, but at least it is password protected to a reasonable degree. Then each one has a laptop. Each one has a fingerprint reader. And in the pilot, we had a digital camera to take people's pictures as well. As it is, in the main system, the Accountant General is taking with them a digital camera and ID card printing system, so that once we have verified the information, it's printed on a card with a photo and a thumbprint. And they actually get sort of the 2008 civil service ID card. That's the technical equipment. Then there's all sorts of other things, generators, surge protectors, UPSs. The power supplies are dreadful. They'll kill your machinery in seconds. Then there's chains and padlocks for your generator, which you're going to leave outside, which will go missing quicker than you. We actually carry all the laptops in a sort of converted metal box of padded. But then there's a small portable photocopier. We tried a scanner printer combination, didn't work. Small portable photocopier, because the volume, as I said, if each person comes in and brings half a dozen documents, that copier works hard. And you then pack loads of every spare you can think of, from AA battery chargers for cameras to spare printer ink. Sorry, my printer's going off again. Moral of the story is, don't get interviewed next to a printer. Come on.
Okay. Right,
we can go on.
All right. Okay, this is part three of the interview with Howard Tetherly. Helpful.
The rest of the kit, obviously, a decent 4x4, which can take. Our interview team is a team leader, three interviewers, and a driver. So that's basically two people in the front seats, three in the middle seat, and the back is just full of kit. Because by the time you've got a generator, a photocopier, three laptops, and overnight bags for four people, it's a full car. But it fits in one car. We put a lot of effort into finding and specifying the kit to make sure it did.
And I assume there are going to be some added challenges by doing this in the rainy season?
Yes. The planning becomes very interesting. You have to give a day to go 50 miles at times. You just have to make sure you do your difficult transfers over the weekend, for example. So we will do a Monday to Friday in one location, finish Friday lunch, then the team stays on and moves 30 miles up country. This is actually the transfer that's happening this weekend. They're transferring. It's only 30 miles. It's about the worst road that we're going to travel, and they have the whole weekend to do it, so they can be ready on Monday morning at the next location. So we're paying all of their per diems and everything to keep them over the weekend. here goes my phone.
All right, I believe this is part four with Howard Tetherly. Go ahead.
Okay, so yes, the wet season makes life tough, because planning for transport and time taken to get around the place is huge. The capability of your cars has to be much improved, and the contingency of having cars break down, get bogged in, stuck, etc. It's also quite high. So contingency planning is awful, and all your kit gets wet at a regular basis. So you have to have waterproof metal boxes to put everything in, so that you don't lose kit, and your staff get wet too.
And is there concern about reaching people who might be outside of the capital in the districts, or are most people located in the main cities?
We had a great conversation about that. We worked out that if we applied the pilot mechanism, where we went to every location and still wanted to do it in the 4 months that the government was desperate for us to get results in, we would need 7 vehicles. And it was actually then going to be cheaper, rather than buy 7 vehicles, to pay a taxi to go to leave Freetown, collect each individual person, bring them here, interview them, and take them back. So a compromise was struck that we went to every major location. So we're going to every major town in Sierra Leone. So that's half of the people are actually in the Freetown area and the peninsula. So we have two interview teams permanently in East and West Freetown. And then we have two teams who basically travel, and they travel hard. So we're going to every single major location. We stay there for at least a week, and we go there at least twice. And we expect people to be able to visit their place. These are all the main administration centres. So we publish where we're going to be. On the main sites, Bow and McKennie, we go to three times. So you have at least two opportunities to go to your nearest town. That's 2 week-long opportunities. Plus, if you're ever coming, you have a 3-month opportunity if you're ever coming into Freetown to be interviewed. And that schedule is in the papers, and it's announced on local radio when we're going to be here. And as we leave a location, we say when we're going to come back. So it's a case of, yes, there are people who will have to travel, from an agricultural research centre, such and such. But we hope that they can time that travel with some other work. So if they know we're going to be there that week, they can say, "Well, I'm going in on Tuesday. I'll be interviewed then." Because we don't give people interviews and say you must show up. We are there for 2 weeks in every single location, and you come at a time convenient to you. And if you miss us in sort of one town, you can come to another, and hopefully we get everybody that way. It is a compromise.
Excellent. Can I ask you a little bit about relationships between the organization here and the work that you're doing and the donors that are sort of behind this project, and if how well that collaboration, I guess particularly with DFID in this case, has gone?
It's interesting. Very well in this case. The initial projects had some World Bank funding, but I think they bought a big photocopier printer, and they didn't even, the photocopier didn't show up, and the funding took so long, and then it comes through sort of a government agency, which then took so long, the photocopier didn't show up in the duration of the project. However, this one, I haven't been on a project which has had such good stakeholder backing. That's one of the reasons we're successful. I mentioned earlier that we got an executive order to get rid of everybody. The ghosts who didn't show up. The establishment secretary said, "I'm not sure what the legal situation is about getting rid of people." So we talked it through and said, "We need an executive order from cabinet to back this up." And we were working out this on the car on the way home, so came back. And Maniru, the project manager, went out and asked for this. And that was in the morning. By mid-afternoon, we had an executive order signed by every single member of the cabinet, including the president, on the establishment secretary's desk saying, "Get rid of them." That's stakeholder backing. When the Minister of Health sees you waiting outside his door, leaves a meeting to come out and sign a press release, because it's got to go say these members of staff have not attended and I've got 2 weeks left. You've got stakeholder backing. So our stakeholders are great. So DFID coughed up the cash. We were very careful to report back to them. And they were, because it went well, it was very easy for them to manage and for us to do. So if it goes well, it's an easy project to manage, and the relationship went well. So couldn't ask for much more. And now they're one of our biggest they sing our praises all over. So in fact, they're doing a case study on us as well.
That's great. What do you have a sense of what has sort of created the environment for this political will to be behind this so strongly?
Political will is useful, and having a project manager who just knows everybody. I can do the technical organisation, I can manage a project, but Maniru taught at Furubay College and knows pretty much every major civil servant and an awful lot of the ministers. So the ministers have got a real boot behind them, and the civil servants sort of will open the door to our program manager, and between the, and I think everybody's it's a case of if you give the dog a good name, it's everybody's pet.
And in your experience here or elsewhere, are there mistakes that you have commonly observed that donors or international organizations make in their relationships with host country personnel? Or
I don't think my experience is wide enough to answer that. So
sure.
No.
So in, as I said, I think that this is an excellent opportunity for people to learn from a program like this. So what is some key advice that you would give to other people?
Start with the record. Start with your stakeholders and make sure they seriously are on board. Involve them often. Then technically follow the methodology. Start with the records. Then get the computerization helps only at the interview stage. Plan your interviews carefully and verify the information in the interview, and then the interview data is recommended. It comes back with as recommendations which you review against the evidence. If the evidence doesn't support something, don't change it. So it's an evidence-based methodology. So you're collecting evidence at interview, and if someone says, oh, well, my date of birth is the 1st of the 1st, 1970, don't believe them until they come up with the evidence, and the evidence collected by the interviewer is reviewed by another random member of the team, and on the way, and effectively it's a common sense of, that's a copy, or they signed an original piece of the original contract of employment says this, so we're going to stick with it. You review the evidence and then you take the data. Apart from that.
And are there other challenges that you've faced in working on the project that you've had to work around?
Well, malaria, typhoid. I haven't had typhoid personally, but yeah. In Sierra Leone is not an easy working environment. Your cars break down at awesome rates of repair, and then your staff almost more so.
And how have you dealt with that?
Money. You budget to repair, to service your cars monthly. You have a budget to send your staff to doctors and pharmacists. You take care. And if you're lucky, you get malaria over a weekend. It can be cured. The right drugs take it out in 3 days, so you're fine.
Excellent. And is there anything else about the project that you'd like to speak about that I haven't asked? Or about any other experience you've had with civil service reform in general?
I think you pretty much covered it.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you speaking with us. Go ahead and stop this.